Our next session is actually about emotions. The good, the bad, and the ugly. Is there a more skillful way to express our emotions? Emotions are a natural part of being human. Our positive emotions make us and others around us feel better, while our negative emotions can have a negative impact on ourselves, our families, our relationships with others. Some destructive emotions may even lead to harming oneself and harming society. So how can we navigate our own emotions through difficult times and especially in times of conflict with others? Do we have any control over them? And if so, how can we express our emotions effectively? So Ajahn Brahm is our first speaker, who will be talking about the Buddhist practice of self-compassion for well-being.
Very good. Okay, and I am going to break new ground today by having a PowerPoint, which I always said I would never do. So, how to have self-compassion and overcome enmity. I did mention this yesterday, but I wanted to show everybody because it's so important for mindfulness-based treatments to show even the Buddha said it's not enough. So I'll let you read it out yourself. You've all got eyes. Actually, you've got to scroll up a bit. Did you get the last bit? Here's another passage, the next line. That's why I don't do PowerPoints. Where is it going? I've got it on a piece of paper. The last line is, he's not free from enmity, but one whose mind all day and night takes delight in harmlessness, who has loving kindness for all beings. For them there is enmity with no one. So it was not just the mindfulness, but the Buddha was saying, one whose mind all day and night takes delight in harmlessness, who has loving kindness for all beings, for them there is enmity with no one. And that's in the Mahabada Yaka Samyutta in the Samyutta Nikaya, number 10 of the 10th section. I mention that because sometimes if you come to conferences like this, and you hear what you already believe, you're not challenged, it's a whole waste of time. We want to make sure it's increased and we do things better. Which is why the compassion, the kindness is an important ingredient. Now, I was not supposed to give this presentation. It was supposed to be somebody else. I unfortunately couldn't make it. So, it's one of the reasons why I'm breaking new ground with my second PowerPoint. And hopefully we've got all of this. So it'd be great, not just mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, compassion-based stress reduction, and wisdom-based stress reduction. Here we go. No sound.
There was a king. Now this king, he was mad cool, right? He didn't like to be in the palace. He liked to go out, go on his own, get away, go to nature, and just chill. So every now and then, he would just take his horse and just go. But one day, when the king was gone, a monster showed up at the palace door. Boom. boom, 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 boom. The monster knocked on the door, and one of the guards opened it. He took one look at this monster and said, "What the f***? You ugly, dirty monster, get the hell out of here. What are you doing on the king's doorstep? You don't deserve to be here. Go, get away." And with every word of negativity, unkindness, and pushing away, that monster grew bigger and bigger and bigger. Until the monster was so big that he just pushed the guard out of the way, stepped on him, and knocked a hole through the palace door. And now, the monster was in the king's palace. Now, these other guards heard all the noise, and so they came running to see WTF was going on. They see this ugly monster and say, Who let you in the king's palace? No, 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 no. You should not be here. Get the hell out of here, you ugly, dirty, smelly monster. Leave now. And with every word of negativity, unkindness, pushing away, that monster grew bigger, more ugly, and more smelly. And then the monster just walked up, right up to the king's throne, flopped on top of the throne. The monster is now taking control of the palace. But one of the king's closest men, the last man in the palace, he stayed back, observing. And he said to himself, the king will know what to do. So he hopped on his horse and went to find the king. He finds the king and he's like, "King, you're not going to believe what happened. Your palace has been taken over by a monster." Now the king was a very wise king, right? I told you he was cool. He was wise. So he took a deep breath and said, "Okay, take me to him." And so they roll back to the palace, and the king walks in the front. He sees the hole in the wall where the palace door used to be. He walks up to the monster and says, "Welcome. It's good to see you. How you doing? Is everything okay?" And with every word of kindness, compassion, and acceptance, that monster grew smaller and smaller and smaller. "Hey, monster, you know, you smell a little foul. You ever taken a bath in a golden bathtub before? Maze, please take care of my friend. Clean him up real good." And with every word of kindness, welcoming, and acceptance, that monster got smaller and smaller. Until the king finally said, "You know what, monster? You can stay here as long as you like." And at that moment, that monster disappeared. The moral of this story is the monster inside of us, the anger, the jealousy, the negativity, the depression, that we try to push out. "You don't belong here. Get out." When we do that, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. But if we approach it with kindness, acceptance, make peace with it, and take care of it, that monster will eventually disappear. Peace.
And any of you who've ever been to any of my talks, seen my talks on YouTube, read my books, will recognize that as the anger-eating monster simile. And I don't mind showing that on there because he plagiarized it. So I plagiarize it back by showing it to you. But I'm sure that nobody minds sharing from one another because that comes again from a Buddha's teaching, the anger-eating monster. That's also in the Yakasamyutta. But that is goes to the heart of some of the questions which I was asked earlier about addiction, about, you know, the throbbing in the head, about this idea there's something wrong with us and we try and get rid of it. I can't meditate properly. I can't sleep well at night. It's the kindness, the acceptance is one of the wonderful therapies. And I've even gone so far as used that for cancers. Chuma, welcome. Thank you for coming to visit me. Which is radical. But it works. Weird, but true. And so sometimes the self-compassion is not being kind to get a result or to get an outcome. It's not outcome-based. It's kindness for the sake of being kind. Some years ago, we were just discussing about, you know, the way to be happy in life. Do you have to work hard and then you're happy? That success makes you happy? And then people like Daniel Goleman came along and said, no. Happy people become successful. And I disagree with both of those. A happy person is success. So anyone here who's happy right now, you're successful. You've arrived. You've arrived, baby. You've arrived. So some of that is actually just radical, but it actually works. And of course, that self-compassion, or what I was challenging, you know, if in Buddhism we don't believe in a self, it's called no self-compassion. And we have to actually practice, you know, our teachings. So in the monastery in which I live, because there's 25 monks, you know, we just have a buffet. But there's always two lines in our buffet. There's the line for the unenlightened monks, that's the self-service. And for the monks who are already enlightened, that's the no-self service. So self-compassion is a bit a weird word. It's an oxymoron for me. So there is many, many wonderful ways and simple ways of having self-compassion, or non-self-compassion, just you know what I mean. Simple practices. And there's one which I learnt when I was a student, Buddhism, meditation, but this was a skillful means which you try and share with people. So you come here and you get to know what goes on, and so you can take it home and share it with others. And that was, my teacher looked at me and said, "You're really miserable." And asked me to say, "When you get up in the morning, what's the first thing you do?" And say, "Go to the toilet, the restroom." "What do you do in there?" "Well, you know." "But is there a mirror in there?" "See, of course there is." "And so after you've been to the restroom, then have a look at yourself in a mirror and smile at yourself." And I said, "Look, Master, you just don't know what it's like to be a young person, to be going out late at night. I'd be scared to look at myself in a mirror." At which point he said, "Look in a mirror, and if you can't manage a natural smile, take your two fingers and push up." And I did that for 2 years as a student. The two-finger smile. I couldn't manage one myself, but I did one, looked at the mirror and saw this stupid young man making a face. A natural smile came. Saw this stupid young man making a smile. I smiled more. The man in the mirror smiled more. And I started every day laughing at myself. That was a beautiful exercise of self-compassion. All you need is a mirror. And I've been teaching that to people for so many years around the world. If ever you go into the restroom and you see someone making a smile on their face, you know where they got it from. Because a little bit of kindness, not taking yourself so seriously, really helps. And just lastly, something practical. If you ever feel depressed, if you're really having a hard day, just go down there into the restroom and try that. Or try this method, which I was reminded of, a little bit of self-compassion. You know, as a monk, you know, we can't, it's against our rules for a woman to hug us. And if a man hugs us, sometimes even more so, they say, "Oh, we always wondered what you guys did in the monastery. You're all gay." but it's really difficult when a monk needs a hug. So what do? Follow what I'm doing now. Arms out. That's right. Bring them in. Follow me. Do it properly. Come on. What's interesting is those people who felt embarrassed doing that, who couldn't do it. You're the people who need it the most. You need a bit of self-compassion, not taking yourself so seriously, and also giving yourself some forgiveness. Any problem you have, remember that story of the anger-eating monster. Being aware of it, using willpower, just makes it worse, makes it bigger. Being kind, whoever you are, whatever you're doing, say, welcome me. Thank you for being who I am. I told bad jokes. Not my fault. It's my conditioning. My father told bad jokes. You know his worst joke? I've only got 5 seconds and it's a short joke. He used to come home and say, you know what fun a monk has? The answer was none. Time to stop. Thank you very much. By the way, that's not true.
Thank you so much. I'm gonna do that hug again. Right there. Thank you so much. I'd like to introduce our next speaker, Venerable Young Ku, who is an advocate of humanistic Buddhism, is the abbess of Fo Guan Shan Temple in Toronto, and abbess of IBPS of Ottawa and Montreal. She has served as the head of student affairs at the Women's Buddhist College at the Chinese Buddhism Research Initiative and the head of the Office of Academic Affairs at Taipei Women's Buddhist College. And today, Venerable Young Ku will be talking about Buddhist mindfulness practice and anger management. Please join me in welcoming her.
Bhante Saranapala and venerables and ladies and gentlemen, good morning. I believe after the first day of the conference, you've all deepened your understanding of how the Buddhist concept of mindfulness and neuroscience can contribute to our mental well-being. First of all, I must thank the Buddhist Advisory Committee of this conference, Bhante Saranapala, for inviting me to share with you all about mindfulness and anger management. I wonder if Bhante knows about my past. But I do think he has found the right person to talk about this topic. Before I go further to discuss more, why don't I share with you all a little story of mine? It's about my anger management experience. When I was a teenager, I was truly a perfectionist, and I often set high standards for myself and others. That's why I won myself a nickname, the Dictator. Not to mention my brothers and sisters, even my neighbors' children would try running away from me. After I became a monastic, I've gained more knowledge. And that's why I thought I had all good reasons to demand others to act in accordance with the Dharma. When things couldn't meet my standard, I could feel moody for a few days. Later on, I heard others calling me the moody queen. I didn't understand what's wrong with just demanding others to do the right things. Why people get intimidated by me. Until one day, my master, Venerable Master Xing Yun, taught me a valuable lesson, which helped me to transform my detector and moody queen images. I remember, that was 33 years ago when I was a student at the Buddhist college. I very disagreed with a teacher's style of work, so I often refused to cooperate with her. At that time, Venerable Master Xing Yun was the principal of the Buddhist college. He must have heard about the situation, so he called me to his office. When I was there, I kept complaining about the teacher for almost 30 minutes. Surprisingly, the master didn't blame me for my faults. Rather, he asked me, "Is that all? You seem like you can say more." After patiently listening to all my complaints, the master looked at me with great compassion and said, "Yonggu, you are a perfectionist. You have a strong sense of justice, and you never confuse what is right and what is wrong. You would never reconcile the good with the evil." I was happy when hearing my master praising me. I thought he really loved me. But the master continued, "However, what you don't realize is that this is a half and half world, half daytime, half nighttime, half brightness, half darkness, half beautiful, half disgraceful, half abiding by the Dharma, half against the Dharma, half is right, half is wrong, half you like, half you don't like. But for you, you can only accept the good, beautiful, positive, and delightful side. Seeing half of the whole is incomplete. Aren't you the perfectionist? But sadly, what you have is just an incomplete world." I had long been proud of myself as a perfectionist. But after hearing what the master said, I suddenly realized I only understood so little. I doubted about myself. I couldn't help but feel lost and depressed at this moment. The master used his finger to write a word in the air. The word was big, like this. In Chinese, big. He hoped that I could cultivate a broad mind that could embrace even the darkness, the disgraceful, and those against the Dharma. That is how I can embrace a complete world. Master's words let me to become more accepting to people and things that do not go my way. And I'm more tolerant of others as it allows me to become more accepting and understanding. Gradually, I have become less self-centered and less likely to become upset. From my personal story, we can see that emotion management can be learned. Actually, 2,500 years ago, Buddhism has already developed a thorough system in the study of psychology. Buddha taught 84,000 teachings to solve all beings' 84,000 delusions. The mind only school puts the human emotions into 51 kinds, and negative emotions have taken over one half of the categories. In all delusions, anger can be said to be the most powerful and the quickest, and it is the most destructive factor in human relations. A medical study reports that when a person is under the pressure of being unhappy or angry, the brain will release harmful substance, and not only do they harm the body, but also affects the person's relationship with others, leading to depression and anxiety. In the Buddha's teachings, anger have 5 negative effects. First, unpleasant facial. Second, loss of reasoning. Third, distance from positive influence. Fourth, break the precepts. Lastly, self-destruction. When a person is angry, they do not have a pleasant facial expression. They also do not speak well when angry. As a result, friends distance themselves, and at the end, bad karma will create, which lead to transgression again. Anger has so many negative effects. How can we control our emotions? As they say in Chinese, there are no high and lows, but only those who can handle crisis. There are some who use meditation to calm the mind, settling the agitating emotions. Some pay respect to the Buddha and attend services to clean away the mind's impurities. Others chant sutras or hold mantras to stop delusions from growing and to keep the mind calm. In times where knowledge and information are constantly changing, people are becoming more and more restless and easily angry. Buddha told us the right mindfulness, and I believe it best suits the busy people of our times. The Chinese words of thought, this present mind. If a person can maintain in constant state of right mindfulness, then even in the face of adversity, they can view it as the effect of rising conditions and fully understand the origins of the angry emotion. It is good to know one's emotions, do not need to delay or avoid them. Once you carry the right mindfulness and understand the conditions, there is nothing that we can upset you. At the end, I want to share that right mindfulness is not only understanding the present, it also means the right view. But changing my temper, I have benefited from taking in many more right views and perceptives. By not seeking comfort for myself, but only wishing sentient beings would be free from suffering, many things will become more carefree, and the mind will naturally settle, and no anger arise. Thank you for listening and letting me share some of my experience with you this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Venerable Yunku. I'd like to introduce our next speaker, who is Aya Medhanandi. Aya Medhanandi is the author of Gone Forth, Going Beyond. She was ordained in Myanmar and received full ordination as a bhikkhuni in Taiwan. She has taught many meditation retreats and is founder and guiding teacher of Sati Saranaya Hermitage, the first Canadian Theravadan training monastery for women. And today, she will be talking about destructive emotions, those that cause self-harm and those that cause harm to others. What are the challenges and what are the remedies? Please join me in welcoming her.
My respects to the Mahasangha. Could I have light? I'm just seeing. I want to see you, not the light. That's better. Self-harm. Harming others. Actually, self-harm is the beginning of harming others. And harming others just increases self-harm. The Buddha talked about this from the beginning, and there's a very beautiful story about Angulimala, the murderer. Angulimala means a garland of fingers. Originally, he was a student named Ahimsaka. He was interested in peace. That was the meaning of his name. But he became so indoctrinated by his teacher, speaking of wrong teachers, that he was set off on a journey to collect 1,000 fingers, and that would give him the secret that the teacher could then pass on to him. Angulimala became a serial killer, and the Buddha knew about this, and actually through his mental powers, realized Angulimala's potential to stop. He went out into the forest where Angulimala was living, and he walked along. Angulimala was actually setting out to kill his mother, which is the most heinous deed that we can commit as a human being. And the Buddha was going to stop him. All he did was walk in the forest. Angulimala spotted the Buddha and started to chase him. He ran as fast as he could, but he could not catch up with the Buddha. Finally, he yelled, "Stop, recluse! Stop, recluse!" The Buddha was walking at a normal pace. He turned around and he said, "I have stopped. Now you stop too." Angulimala bowed to the Buddha and, not yet, he said first, he was intrigued, "What do you mean, stop?" And then the Buddha explained about stopping the killing of his virtue, the killing of the goodness within him. This is what the Buddha is exhorting us to do, to stop killing the goodness in us. We are all, in a way, serial killers of goodness. Every time that we use speech or action or even think harmful thoughts to others. And in this way, we have to be so mindful of how we act and speak, but our actions and our speech come from our thoughts. I didn't realize this when I was a young woman until I found the Buddha's teachings. I was very aware of the pain of what other people can do to others and the pain of what we do to ourselves. But I didn't have a clear path of how to solve that, how to make that connection. I saw the pain of my parents who had lived through the Holocaust, and I didn't want them to be in pain, to be harmed, to hurt. But I carried their pain inside my own heart for most of my young life. In fact, I still believe that in my body, I carry that pain, but I'm learning to manage it with mindfulness and compassion, with developing the Brahmaviharas, with taking care of this illness within the body itself, which constantly speaks to the mind and triggers in our minds the harming that we continue to do because we believe that this is how we are and this is what we must do. But we can train ourselves by practicing harmlessness. Harmlessness means restraint. It also includes goodwill. We have to be more and more aware and more compassionate. Could I have a bit of water? When I'm nervous, I get thirsty. And I have shaky hands, so it's a constant thing. No. I'll just leave it here for you, okay? That's good. Okay. So, harmlessness is the sister of goodwill. And goodwill is in every positive mind state. If we are watching the screen of the mind instead of the computer, then we have a chance to develop even a moment of peace. Neuroscience has shown, and the Buddhist practitioners have experienced, the accumulation and the cumulative effect of negative emotions, destructive emotions, in our own minds and in our hearts. The most negative thing that we can do is to harm and also not to be aware of what that harming is and how it affects us and how that in turn affects others. The world that we create is born here in our hearts. If we take care here, then we take care of each other. If we take care of each other, we take care of ourselves. And we can rejoice in that. But we can't do that by killing the monster out there, as Ajahn Brahm's wonderful little telecast showed us. So if we stop downloading things from the outside and look within and pay more and more attention to caring for that area in us where metta arises, where loving kindness arises, by cultivating sila, which is virtuous conduct, virtuous speech, and virtuous thoughts. This is about right intention, the intention to give up that which destroys us. It's an inner disarmament. We ask the world to put down its weapons, but we carry these weapons within us, and we can learn how to put those weapons down. When I was a young woman, before I became a nun, I was working in Senegal, and I was traveling in the Casamance. And I was approached by a young man. Actually, he came behind me and attacked me. And of course, I was terrified. But I had been living next door to a mosque for quite some time. And every morning when I meditated, I would hear the chanting from the mosque, Allah Akbar. And when he attacked me, I started to chant that chant. It was the very thing that I had heard that morning. And he stopped, just like Angulimala. He stopped. He got up and he said, "What's that? Are you a nun?" And I said, "No, that was very interesting. I wasn't a nun." He said, "What are you chanting?" I said, "I'm chanting for help to the divine. Who else will hear me?" So he said, "Okay, I won't hurt you." And he got up. And I sat there looking at him in disbelief. But he did. He got up and said, "I will not hurt you." Then he said, "What do you have in your bag?" And I said, "I have $200. He said, "Okay, give me money." And I said, "No, I won't give you anything except forgiveness." And then he said, "I just need a little money to give the priest." He was a Christian, and he wanted to go to the priest and ask for forgiveness. So I gave him 25 cents. And he went away. Forgiveness is really the light that guides us through this terrible maze of the world's trappings and our own inner weaknesses and low opinions of ourselves. These are the things that begin the destruction. None of us here, I don't think, are serial killers like Angulimala. But Angulimala did bow down to the Buddha and became a monk. He became a man of peace after killing 999 people. Think of that as rehabilitation. We must never give up on anyone, especially ourselves. The Buddha gave Angulimala the greatest gift that a human being can receive, and that is the gift of the Dhamma, the gift of harmlessness, the gift of knowing that forgiveness for ourselves, even if we feel that we are unworthy or that we cannot live up to our expectations, we carry that message to other people in some subtle form. We become the victim. We become the target for other people's mistreatment or unskillfulness. But if we practice gentleness and kindness from the depths of our despair towards ourselves, then other people will also look and feel and sense, yes, this is worthy. Here I can help. And they come. And then we help each other. Our disarmament is an internal one. We can't expect from the world what we ourselves are not doing. If we go out and protest in anger, we could end up hurting someone. Do you remember the time when there were clinics in the United States being attacked because they were performing abortions, and one of the protesters who was protesting for the right to life killed a doctor who was performing an abortion? What madness! What is the real message here? That all the destructivity, all the unskillfulness, all the anger, all the hatred, all the bombs are going off within us first. And if we're mindful of our speech, then not to open these two mouths, someone said, if you're swimming or if you're angry, these two lips, they are two mouths. One is an angry mouth and one is a gentle mouth. If we can speak out of gentleness, if we can act, I've noticed that more and more as I practice, because I have faith in this teaching and I've been practicing for decades, and it's just when you think that you've climbed so high in the mountain and you fall down and you have to hold on with your bare fingers that you realize there's still a way to go. So we can't sit back on our good deeds and think, I'm so great, because this is pride. We have to really be so meticulous in our mindfulness, in our awareness of what's going on in here, and then keep climbing, and then reach out to help others climb up that steep slope as much as we can. I'm looking at the minutes. There's a context for this, to take this out into our daily life and be aware when there is an angry feeling. See the tension in the body. The body knows when we're angry. We tense up and we can see right then. This is what the Buddha said to his little son Rahula. He said, when you have finished doing something and you see that it was unskillful, then know next time not to do it. Or if you have spoken words that were like grenades, then know next time not to throw them. I'm rephrasing. And if you notice in the middle of doing something unskillful, then stop if you can, restrain. And if you notice that you're speaking in an unkind way, gossiping about somebody else, just to make an impression, then stop. These might not seem like destructive things, but they're incredibly harmful. They are like grenades. And the best thing of all is if we can remember, before we make that move, before we speak, we should stop and not go there. Instead, go to the deepest loving kindness, self-compassion that we can bring up in ourselves and spread that through the mind. That is the greatest gift for each of us and for everyone. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so very much for that wonderful and enlightening talk. Now I'd like to open it up again to some Q&A, but before we do that, I'd like to ask Cindy, our translator for Venerable Young Ku. Oh, there you are. I'm going to give this mic to you. And also, we would like just everyone to know that if you do have questions, please come over to the center mic and ask from over there, okay?
So I go?
Okay. Yes.
Good morning. My name is Jenny, and I'm glad I got the opportunity, and thank you for having this conference. So very briefly, I work as a counselor, employment counselor and social service worker, but also at social justice movement for some time. And I work in the post-secondary education system where everybody is embraced and we accommodate under human rights and any designated groups for inclusion and diversity. Through my work, I found out that it's all about targets. Through pharmaceutical industries that need support in their products, and for the government to have targets to help. So through my work, I've also had young kids that grow up and now in post-secondary education. And I find it's very interesting, and I'm shaking right now. Please forgive me. I'm going to try to be as calm as I can. Through this life, I find all of a sudden I get a call to say, you know, I'm having a breakdown. I want you to come to university, or else I would harm myself. So I rush from work, only to find that my young kid is sitting in an emergency, trying to see if bullying will stop or if she should take her life. They keep them for 24 hours. They load them with medication, but they send them home with a gift with a label to state that they are diagnosed with something. And then these kids grow up and say, you know, this is who I am. I have this sickness. I have this. This is what the world has labeled me with. And they come back trying to get back into society. So then you find kids who feel that they will never belong to anywhere. And as my son, who was 7 years old, came to Ajahn Brahm's first talk in Toronto and went to the mic and said, why don't people like me? Why can't I have friends? And Ajahn Brahm responded to say, you like yourself? You know, and he's a grown man today. But in post-secondary, they have the opportunity to say, you cannot be happy in your body. We will welcome you. You can go through transition. You can go through transition to health, to a surgical process or any medication. Yes, there are resources that they help them, but they let them loose. But as a mother, I'm willing to let go, but I cannot give up. And I ask this community, how can we help these children? I know there are many who don't want to talk about it, but if we don't, we will not support them. Yesterday I heard Ramajiva Venerable talk about begging for help. Do we have to beg to help our next generation? Do we not have responsibility? My question is for any resources or any help that we can help these kids with. It's not coming out with a degree or something after their name. It's about bringing the two parts of mindfulness and neuroscience to help them. Thank you. So it's about transgender. It's about wanting to be transgender. Autistic kids today feel that this is the community will accept them. So this government supports through the healthcare system to help them become transgender. But I've seen through working with students, once they're halfway through, they look back and say, this is not for me, but it's too late. And thereafter, there is no help. And this is why we need to help them before to be proactive, not to be able to ruin themselves.
Quickly, it's such a big question, and it's always you do see people who feel marginalized and who feel stigmatized, who feel they do not belong, and this is one of the reasons why there's huge problems, sociological problems, psychological problems, and health problems. It's wonderful to have a society which does respect everybody, does not marginalize anybody. It's one of the reasons why, as a monk, it's not just sitting in your monastery. It's trying to sort of change attitudes. Monks do have an influence. Nuns have an influence. Just we need to work hard in all levels to make sure there's equity and acceptance for all women. I mean, whatever they really feel they need to do. It's important that we have this loving kindness for everybody, which embraces everybody. And it's also, I think, just the way we label people. As a school teacher, I remember a very life-changing episode for me when I read about when you stream children. I won't go in detail to this, but two classes of children, exactly equal, but they never knew they were equal. The next year they put one as class A, the other one as class B. And they actually believe that, even though they'd done equally well the year before, at the end of the year when they gave the exam, that the people who were called class A became class A children. The people who were called class B became class B kids. They performed so badly. And because of that, if we call a person schizophrenic, if we call a person ADD, if we call a person transgender or whatever, the latest article that many people in our modern world, they are allowed to change their gender specification several times in their life. Choice. Challenges. But if that's what they feel they need to be comfortable, I can't see any reason why not. Going into prisons, I've never seen a criminal, I've never seen a rapist, I've never seen a thief, I've never seen a murderer. All I've ever seen is a person who's committed a murder. I've seen a man who has molested children. But they are not a paedophile. They're a person. And when I see that, they see that, and they can change. As Angie knows, I said in the first talk, I think, on Friday night, great guy over in Singapore, the head of schizophrenia, a Catholic, I asked him, how do you treat schizophrenia? He said, I do not treat schizophrenia. I treat the other half of the patient. And I thought, that fellow has got his head on. There is no such thing as a schizophrenic. There's a person who sometimes have episodes of schizophrenia. Look at the other part. Don't label them. Otherwise they become what you label them. And that is half the problem in our society. Labeling, and people live up to those labels. So there's a psychology there, there's a wisdom, there's a kindness, there's a compassion there, which actually heals. And it works. This is not just theory, because I learned how the power of this. I don't mind sort of praising myself every now and again, because this is, you know, saying it works. One of the most memorable pieces of praise I've ever received in my life, and one I will remember on my deathbed, if I die in a bed. Probably die in a conference somewhere. But was saying, he asked me, can you please go back to our prison? I said, can't do it, too busy. I'll send somebody else. He said, no, we want you. Why me? It's because all the people who ever went to my classes in prison never went back to jail afterwards. When they were released, they left. They never came back. And I asked, why? What have I done? And it was because I never ever saw a criminal. I saw a person. Gave them respect. Gave them something else to look at. So look, if your son has got whatever problem, they're bigger than that. Please let them see they are not, you know, the problem which some psychologists or psychiatrists label them with. They're much more huge than that. And that guy in Singapore, brilliant fellow, great way to treat episodes of schizophrenia. Look at the other part. It works. That's the best I can offer, sorry.
Thank you.
I will speak in Mandarin, and Cindy translate for me. Thank you. 我想这位女士所提到的问题，应该也是我们在座每一个人都是关心的问题。
I think the question that the lady just asked should be some questions that we all should be concerned about.
我听到刚刚这位女士的发言，我觉得她承受很大的压力，内心很辛苦。
I can understand that lady is experiencing tremendous pressure. Must be very hard for her.
我想要分享的就是说，我们的世界啊，就是外境发生在我们身边一切的事情，其实是我们内心的显现。
What I want to share with you is the thing that apparently experience in our exterior world. Actually, it is something imaging from our own mind.
举例说，我听到我的一位师兄 ，my Dharma brother， 我的师兄告诉我，有人说我不好。
For example, I heard from one of my Dharma brother saying that some people say that I'm not good.
我听了之后，我告诉他，我说，你不要生气，问题不在他，问题在我。
So after I hear that, I talk to my Dharma brother. I ask him, don't be upset. The problem is not on that person. It must be on me.
外面有人批评我，或者外面有不好的事情发生，其实是我说是我还没有修行圆满，是我的内心世界还有尘垢，所以表现出来的世界就不完美了。
If there is thing that have apparently not doing well in the exterior world in the environment, it must be because inside my mind there still be some impurity.Still, I haven't reached the completeness stage.
所以我想建议这位女士，你要更坚强，你要加强你的信仰，你的信心。当你的心稳定下来了，就好像那个时钟啊，你的心，你的世界，你是核心。时钟分针、秒针是绕着你的心在跑，你必须要定下来，不要着急，不要茫然。惶恐，你定下来，你的世界就会很有规律的走了。
So this is the suggestion I would like to give to the ladies. Please try to stable your mind, be strong, have faith. Just like a clock, you are always standing in the center, and the two arms just like the things happening around the world. No matter how they turn, you are always stable.
我想再 ，Thank you. 我想再分享一件事情，就是当你的心跟佛法相应的时候，那是最大的力量。
And I also want to emphasize that the time when you have the strongest strength is the time when you are having an interaction, you are embodying the Dharma.
我要分享我一个经验，就是我在大约八年前啊，医生告诉我。我有癌症。
I want to share with you my one personal experience. About 8 years ago, doctor tell me I was diagnosed with cancer.
当我听到医生说我有 cancer 的时候，我当下那个当下非常瞬间的那个当下，我问我自己，这个时候我的信仰跟我有什么关系？
Right at that moment, when I heard the doctor say about this, at that moment I asked myself, as a Buddhist, how is my faith has to do with my dealing with this situation?
告诉各位，当我这样回到佛法的原点的时候，突然之间，我全身毛孔，全身充满了欢喜，我感觉到我真正体会到佛陀讲什么叫无我？这个生命我们不能主宰，没有一样可以固定。我当时是用生命去体验什么叫无我，所以有那种真正见法，不是从知识上理解的对佛法的理解，而是用生命去经历体验什么是叫无我。所以突然之间法喜充满，非常欢喜。
When I reconnect myself to the Dharma, I instantly feel the joy within me. At that time, I finally realized what is no self. Life is something that we cannot control, and also everything is temporal. I found myself, I'm no longer using knowledge to interpret Dharma. This time, I'm using my own life, my body, to experience the Dharma, to experience the joy of Dharma.
后来医生接着说啊，因为身体是你的，后面要怎么样治疗你来决定。我回答医生说，因为身体不是我的，还是你决定吧。
The doctor then continued to say, because the body is yours, let you decide what you're going to do with the treatment. Then I tell the doctor, because the body is not mine, so why don't you decide about my treatment?
然后 ，Thank you。大约就在各种的检查确认是良性肿瘤、恶性肿瘤，在这些检查之后，化验报告出来了，医生跟我说：“哦，没事了，你是奇迹，你身上的癌细胞竟然变成零啊。”
After doing more and more testing, one day the doctor called me back and told me we experienced a miracle.Because in your body, the number of cancer cells becomes zero.
我当时在想，在我身上发生了什么事情？我不过是经历了一个佛法的体会，然后我的细胞完全改变。其实我有一点失望的。
At that time, I asked myself, what was happening?I think I am experiencing Dharma. Honestly, I am a little bit disappointed.
因为我本来已经做好准备，我要去上一堂课。我如果可以通过这一堂课的学习，我以后应该是会是更好的老师，我可以分享更多生命的经验去鼓励别人啊！但是我竟然就失去了上课的机会，我其实是小小有一点失望啊。
The reason why I'm a little bit disappointed is because I feel that I'm already for this big lesson of life. If I experience it, I must be able to tell other, to share with other a lot more, and I'm all prepared. But unfortunately, I'm cured.
所以我只是想要跟这位女士讲，虽然我现在看不到你坐在哪里，不要放弃， never give up， 不要放弃，然后你要更有定力，你要加强深化，就更扎根更深啊，深化你的信仰，你的修行，只有你定下来，你就有力量可以帮助别人。你的 mindfulness， 你的正念，将可以改变你的世界。
Although I cannot see now where is the lady sitting, but I really want to look at her and tell her, please have faith, have confidence. Let the Dharma deeply root in your body, in your mind. Then you are able to deal with whatever you're experiencing.
Buddha bless you.
May Buddha bless you.
Thank you.
We have, I just want to take our attention to one of the live stream questions.
There's a question from Thomas, who would originally like to direct his question towards Venerable Aya Madanli, but I would open the question to the entire panel after she's answered. So this is from Thomas. I work in a hospital, which is sometimes stressful. I have a colleague who is often stressed and angry. He comes to me to talk about it.When this happens, I often listen to him, but I feel his anger is giving rise to, his anger is giving rise to nervousness and anger in me as well. I feel confused, stressed, and my hands are sweaty after he leaves. How can I take care of myself while at the same time listening and helping him? Thank you.
Anger is contagious.But so is loving kindness. So as he's speaking, if you can try to make the space in your heart bigger and make your body bigger, become big like the monster, but make it big like a loving kindness being rather than an angry being, so that what the words fall on is a bigger space. If you're listening with aversion, then that process can't happen.And then the anger sticks in you. It doesn't glide off. It doesn't flow out. But if you can breathe in and out, just meditate on your body and listen with your whole body rather than just with the head. Perhaps you can dissipate the aversion as it arises and listen with compassion, because you can see that people don't speak or act or even think angry thoughts or speak in angry ways unless they're suffering. So the suffering always bears compassion. If we practice compassion for ourselves every day when we wake up, loving kindness, compassion, then we can bring that more easily to the people that we meet. And we don't always meet people who are in a good mood. There is so much suffering around us. And in a hospital, even more so, working with so much sickness and tragedy, trauma, and death, how can he but help being angry?
Thank you. I know we've got a question over here.
Okay. Thank you, my little bit, Julie Yu. This question actually for Venerable Ku. Speaking Mandarin too, so may I ask you to directly. 就是您是修中国传统大乘佛教，就是说有两种基本的那个修行，一个是静坐，就是 meditation， 另一个就是 chanting， 就是诵经。这两种方法对这个 mind， 就是对我们的个人的影响有什么不同 ？So my question is, two kinds of actually practice in Chinese Mahayana, meditation and chanting. Actually, similar question for Aya too. Is this two different kind of practice? What's the difference influence our mind? Thank you.
好啊。一样，我用中文回答啊。其实参禅也好，念佛诵经，包含所有的修行都好，它叫做方法，它是一个过程，但它不是目的啊。我们是通过不同的方法，不管是禅修啊、诵经、念佛啊，通过这个过程、这个方法，然后最终的呢，我们是要达到要。彻底的究竟的觉悟啊，就是智慧开展啊，觉悟的这个目标。
No matter what methods you are using, chanting, sutra or meditation, all of this kind of methods are journey, is a mean helping you to reach the ultimate, the reality, and the final goal is to reach enlightenment.
我看到很多学佛的人啊。在方法上就停下来了，他把过程、把方法当成目的，那么他可能会执着，哦，我现在可以打坐几个钟头，我现在诵了多少几万句佛号啊，多少经，他把方法当成目的，所以最终他没有到达佛陀要我们去的地方。
From what I observe, some of the Buddhist practitioners, they misleadingly treating the means as the goal. They would calculate or they would evaluate how many hours of meditation I can do or how many sutras I have been chanting. This eventually leads them unable to reach their ultimate.
所以我想您刚刚问到说这些法门呢，有什么差别啊？其实，方法不一样，那是因为我们众生的根基不一样，所以每一个人他可以适合不同的方法，只要这些方法，所有的方法，就如同我刚刚讲的，都是佛陀教导我们的方法，但是不要在那上面停下来，你应该要听懂佛陀要我们去的地方。
So earlier when you ask me which methods is better or how are they being different?My answer is there are different methods for different people because our own nature, our behavior are different. All of these methods are taught by Buddhas. As long as you are not attached to the method, avoiding you to reach the goal, then all methods are good.
还是那一句话，法无高下，应机者妙。佛法没有谁大谁小，你相应那个就是最好的。
still there is one word saying, in terms of the method, there is no high or no low. There's no comparative better or worse. As long as it is accustomed to your own needs, then it is good.
我这样有回答你的问题吗?
Did I answer your questions well?
Yes, very well. 谢谢法师分享。
Thank you. We've got time for one last short question. Right over here in front of me. Go ahead. Or you can, yeah, that would work if they can just bring over the mic. Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm a lawyer, and I actually teach lawyers about emotional intelligence and mindfulness, which, as you can imagine, is very difficult because they don't want to know about mindfulness. Once they learn about it, they want more. But getting there is the problem. So the issue that I have is that as law students, we have these positive people going into university wanting to change the world, and our training trains us to be pessimistic and competitive and perfectionist. So we become very sad human beings, and then we have to practice this way. Unfortunately, our mouth is our biggest weapon, and in law, it's our biggest asset. So I find what I have been doing, and thank you so much for sharing what you said, what I've been telling my colleagues is that before you start an email, before you pick up the telephone, or before you're going to talk to somebody, just wait. And wait stands for, why am I talking? And if it's not thoughtful, if it's harmful, if it doesn't inspire confidence in the person that you're going to be talking to, if it's not necessary and it's not kind, then don't say it. And think about what is important to you and your colleague and your clients. So that's one of, because right speech is so important. Are there any other messages that you can share with me that I can share with them to inspire them to have harmlessness in everything that they do in everyday life? And thank you.
You can answer. Feel free. Just we can allow 2 more minutes. That's totally fine.
Thank you for your question. One thing that I didn't managed to squeeze into my talk was that meditation practice is really essential. Mindfulness in daily life is an extension of it. And I want to add that chanting is very helpful too, because it takes us out of the left brain. And as law students, I think there's a lot of left brain work. I think the meditation would be extremely helpful combined with a practice of learning mindfulness in daily life, and with simple activities, what you're doing is brilliant. But try to get them maybe to sit together in silence, to listen to what their own mind's natural editorial commentary is like, and let them edit that using the Buddha's instructions, using qualities of developing generosity, developing compassion, developing wisdom, developing stillness. That's really important, because in such a competitive world, stillness doesn't really come into the picture. And that's why these practices, chanting or meditation, they help to still the citta. It help to wash the laundry in our minds. We wash our own laundry every day, or not every day, we wash our bodies every day. And we wash the laundry once in a while, but the mind is full of dirty laundry. And meditation is about the only opportunity we have to begin a different regime, a different diet. It's the healthiest diet of all, and people seem to have less and less time for that. So what are we eating? Well, we're eating something not very good. Noise, competition, bitterness, ego-building stuff. And we have to keep emptying that out. Day by day, there's no collection service. Like in our monastery, we don't have any collection for our garbage. I mean, physically also. So, and the meditation in a community, if each person isn't emptying the garbage in their own mind by stilling the mental formations and bringing a peaceful, a forgiving, a grateful, a blessing attitude into each other's lives, then we can't live together. And so as law, people of the law, you want to uphold ethics more than profit. So for lawyers, that's a real conundrum. Because lawyers get rich, then how can they really, it's so easy to be seduced by the profit motive in that profession. Let them profess sila, ethics first, and then the law on top of that, and put in the ingredient of stillness, and remember to take out the garbage, and then maybe they can be really good lawyers.
Thank you. Thank you.